This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with the man who heads the Baton Rouge chapter of the NAACP, Kwame Asante, and he has some thoughts about the violent nature of our community and reflections on what happened 5 days ago in Newtown, Connecticut, as 20 school children were slaughtered at a school that was an idyllic place until last Friday. Also on the show, we will visit with Councilman Joel Boy, and he has been at the forefront discussing the murder raid in Baton Rouge and where we go from here. Baton Rouge stands to have another record year for homicides, and we'll talk with Councilman Boy about 2013 with a new council and Mayor Kip Holden returning for a third term as the mayor president. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757 wherever you are. And locally, the call is made by dialing 297-5633. You may reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Did want to note that we were slated to visit today with Chris Matthews, the well-known host and journalist who is featured on MSNBC with his show Hardball, but Chris was unavailable today. He says he will do something with us the first week of January, and we will take him at his word. We do have some fascinating gentlemen to talk with today, including our first guest, Kwame Asante, the gentleman who heads the Baton Rouge chapter of the NAACP. He has for the last 2 years. Previously, he was state director of the organization. And good morning to you, Kwame.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on.
And you grew up in this town, in Baton Rouge, correct?
No, I actually grew up in San Diego, California, and actually came as a transplant in 1989 to Southern University to attend school.
Well, I guess those are formative years in college, so you were almost a grown person when you arrived. I guess you were in your teens, but that's right. 1989 is 23 years ago, almost 24, so you have an appreciation for this area. How did you get involved in the NAACP, Kwame?
I got involved in the NAACP as a student. On campus, I was very disturbed at a couple of events that happened in Baton Rouge. There were some questionable shootings that happened between the police department and African-American youth, and I was really concerned, as a lot of students were. The NAACP had a couple of meetings and rallies that they were bringing people together to talk about the shooting and what needs to be done next, and I was one of those students that was stirred up by that. It happened to be with the late George Washington Eames, actually. I remember meeting him. And from that point on, I said I wanted to be involved in something that was about civil rights or justice. And so that's what started back in 1989-90.
Mm-hmm. I saw you at George Eames's funeral Saturday, and Kwame spoke eloquently about Mr. Civil Rights. He left quite an impression, didn't he?
He did. He did leave an impression, and he was an individual that you always knew where he stood. And through his work in addressing issues of civil rights and discrimination and unfair treatment, He was someone that anyone who wanted to look at someone's work, what someone's desire and passion was, no matter what you felt about his actual politics, you definitely had to admire his dedication to a cause.
297-5633 is your number if you'd like to join the conversation. Our guest is Kwame Asante. He heads the Baton Rouge chapter of the NAACP, and he was formerly the state president, and prior to that, he was for 3 years head of the Baton Rouge chapter from 2007 to, I guess it was around 2004. We go back a long ways now.
Yeah, that's right. I served under Alvin Washington, who was the president during the desegregation suit. I served with him for about 10 years as vice president. And then in 2004, I was elected as president of the NAACP. And as you know, the hurricane hit in 2005. And shortly after that, I was asked by the national NAACP to work around the recovery needs of Louisiana, heading some of our programs. And I was a state director. We had a state president at the time that still is in office. His name is Ernest Johnson, Dr. Ernest Johnson. And I'm very proud to work with him also. But I was state director during that time working with the national office. So I resigned here in Baton Rouge and now just recently in the last 2 years come back as the state president, the local Baton Rouge president here in Baton Rouge.
We already have had a listener, Tim, who wants to know why you went from San Diego to Southern University.
I was one of the students who during that time was very excited about attending a historically black college. I was a student that happened to get a scholarship playing football. I had some relatives who also attended Southern University, and they were students who left San Diego before me. And so it was just a great opportunity to be in the South. It was different from San Diego, and I was excited to come down to Bayou Country. I enjoyed Southern University football, learned to love LSU football, and we had a great time. And so that and the great cooking made me stay.
Well, in the midst of the tragedy last Friday in Newtown, Connecticut, there has been a discussion about where the nation goes from here as far as addressing gun rights. What do you think about what has transpired in the last 5 days?
I think we have to have some very hard conversations. My heart, like everyone else, goes out with the families of the victims. And it really challenges the country to take a deep look at the laws that are on the books right now. How do we protect people as at the same time protect the Constitution? I'm a proponent that I believe in individual rights, but at the same time I am a person who is affected by the fact that I am an African American male who sees the statistics of gun violence that happens on the national level. And then also in the local levels, you look at areas like Chicago, New Orleans, Baton Rouge, where there's a large number of deaths for African-American males with the use of gun violence. So I'm definitely one who is in support of conversations and policy changes that will keep the wrong people away from guns, limit the access, and work with communities to educate the youth around gun violence, and that guns as a way of solving issues is a deadly consequence to a lifestyle. And so I'm really, really for the changes that are being discussed right now. I don't have a specific type of policy that will come down, that I would propose right now. But I'm interested in. We know we have to have change, and so that's what I'm standing behind.
Linda in Denham Springs, good morning to you, Linda. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I was listening to y'all's conversation, and, the last thing you want to do is glorify Mr. Ames. He was in a wheelchair because he was shot from, a wrongdoing.
That is absolutely wrong. That is an untruth. It's been spread for 57 years. The man was shot in the back. He was found on a sidewalk paralyzed. He obviously had not moved. And a two-year investigation by an all-white DA's office in 1958, on the 9th day of January, a report was issued saying that Mr. Eames was shot while he was walking on a sidewalk at the corner of Highland and West Garfield. You are absolutely wrong, Linda. Thank you for calling. Charles in North Baton Rouge. Charles, you're on the air.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Kwame. I have three questions, and I'm African-American. I'm a fan of the NAACP, but I'm also somewhat of a skeptic. As you know, it's also been referred to as the National Association for the Advancement of Certain People. So let me get to my questions. First one is education. I want to know why the NAACP has not challenged the LEAP and the GED tests. Most public school students in Louisiana are African American, and this test is being used for public school students to get a high school diploma, but it's not applied to private schools.
All right, that's a reasonable question. What do you think, Kwame?
I think that that the recent changes in adopting the Common Core standards will be the next step in addressing the issue of the disparate use of the LEAP exam. I agree with the gentleman that we want to see the same type of measure be utilized for both institution types. But we have seen the LEAP, the GEE used in schools, in public and private schools. Private schools have used it as a way of measuring the advancement of their children. But that's the difference in that parents have the choice of sending their children to a private school, and parents have a choice of sending their child to a public school. I think what is most important is the Common Core standards that is going to be adopted. I'm not as concerned about whether a child in private school wants to take the LEAP exam and parents force them to. I'm more concerned about the fourth graders, the eighth graders that are tested and used as a measure to determine whether these children are proficiently on level. What we're seeing now is a large percentage of particularly African-American children. The gap is still very high, still very wide, and so I'm more concerned about where do we go from here? How do we implement the measures, the recovery measures, the remediation measures to be able to see that children who come to school less prepared are able to read on level, do math problems on level, have the critical thinking skills to be able to become productive citizens. That's more of what I'm concerned about and less about whether the public schools, private schools are utilizing one of the standardized tests to determine their children's necessary needs.
Well, in light of the subject that has dominated the headlines over the last few days, stories continue to emanate. A story from Adam Negurny in the New York Times today, and Adam, of course, spent time in New Orleans. In California, Democratic leaders introduced legislation mandating background checks and one-year permits for anyone who wants to buy ammunition. In Michigan, a Republican governor vetoed legislation that would have permitted concealed weapons in schoolhouses, and a private equity company announced that it would sell off the company that made the high-powered assault weapon used in the Newtown shootings last week. The National Rifle Association has broken its silence on the massacre with what it calls an important statement from the NRA, saying that the organization is potentially reconsidering its position. Here's the statement. The NRA is prepared to offer meaningful contributions to make sure this never happens again. Didn't offer details, but it looks like the momentum right now is towards some revisions and perhaps restrictions on what kind of guns can be sold and who can buy them. What do you think of this, Kwame?
I think that's a step in the right direction. There is a anger that is surrounding the country on the profiteering at the expense of public safety. Many people are, like I am, feeling that there is a desire to have the protection within our homes, within our communities, that the right to bear arms does give us. But at the same time, we don't want to jeopardize our public safety by trying to extend an opportunity for folks to go out over the Internet or illegally through gun sales, purchase ammunition and rifles, high-powered rifles, that can be used with these people that are unstable. One of the things that is a big conversation piece is identifying, because guns themselves, by themselves, are not the problem. So it's having the ability for us to identify the behaviors and the characteristics that we're seeing in young people and men and women that are committing these heinous crimes. It's being able to educate people to be very aware, because I don't think that, yes, we can do more to put policy into place. I think we can do a lot of things to safeguard the sales. But there's also some identification, there's also some mental health, there's also some education that we've got to do. And at the same time, as we change the policy to take these high-powered rifles, these certain type of guns that are being used off of the Internet, away from the wrong hands, we've also had to have a dual work in educating the community and people and families and healthcare workers so they can identify the type of behaviors that we're seeing that were clear red flags.
We'll return with Kwame Asante, the head of the Baton Rouge chapter of the NAACP, and we will also be joined shortly by Joel Bowie, Metro Councilman. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Richard Fisher is producing. Our guest for a few minutes longer is Kwame Asante, the president of the Baton Rouge chapter of the NAACP, and we will be joined by Joel Bowie, Metro Councilman, in short order. Barry in Mid-City. Good morning, Barry. You're on the air.
Good morning, and I appreciate your show again very much. I'm just wondering, there are headlines of newspapers all around the country, even in our region, of a rush to buy these high-powered guns and rifles. I don't know if you or your guest could comment on that. I don't understand it.
Well, I guess people think, thank you, Barry. Good to hear from you, Rabbi. People think that they may soon be unavailable, so they're buying them while they can. And what do you think, Kwame?
I think that's a tragic side effect of the events that have evolved in the last number of days. One of the things that we're seeing is that there has been an oversaturation of these high-powered weapons, and it's almost a morbid type of excitement that goes along with the sensationalization of these type of high-powered weapons, the damaging effects. I would be curious to see a study be done about the effects or the after effects of tragedies and what happens with the gun sales in particular communities. And so I'm really, really interested in seeing how we will address cutting off the access to this. How do we track some of these guns? I think that it's important that we continue the type of tracking mechanisms that are in place now to know where these guns are ending up. And then once, you know, we find that these guns are in the wrong hands, that there could be some look at policy around how do we curtail those with bulk guns but have been identified to be a danger to the community through the various other agencies. If a person has a gun in their home, but they're also under some type of doctor's care, mental health doctor's care, where they could be deemed as being a harm to themselves or the community, that we look at what kind of guns are in their home. I think there needs to be real conversation about that, as we saw in the killing in Virginia with a student and a number of other people on campus, and what we've seen go on in Connecticut. It definitely tells us that we need to link mental health policy with what we're doing with gun control.
Well, the Brady gun control law, which was named Jim Brady, the press secretary for President Reagan, who was shot during an assassination attempt March 30th, 1981, on President Reagan, requires licensed gun dealers to screen all prospective gun buyers through a federal database of convicted felons, drug abusers, people with a serious mental illness, and others. And in addition, the law requires licensed dealers to collect information about buyers that can be used later to trace guns that were used in crimes. The law does not cover private sales of guns, and that includes transactions by occasional sellers at gun shows and flea markets. The New York Times opines today that this has become a gaping loophole that has allowed teenagers, ordinary criminals, terrorists, Mexican drug cartels, and arms traffickers to have easy access to weapons. Should something be done about these gun shows, Kwame?
Yes, most definitely. I think that the government needs to address the loophole by dealing with some of the policy gaps that are there. If we have private gun sellers, there needs to be a pre-clearance process, a wait time. I believe that a background check that we utilize in a much more stringent way to be able to determine who's buying these guns. The ability to be able to link that between all the different agencies that are attempting to deal with the public safety aspect. So I think that we definitely have put some safeguards in place that will link the agencies, mental health agencies, national database for crime, whether that be the FBI background searches or localized background searches that will allow people to be able to get the best information as quickly as possible so they can have the information necessary to determine whether this person is legally able to obtain a gun.
297-5633 is your number, and we'll keep Kwame on the line for a few more minutes. And we're joined now by Joel Boy, who began serving as the District 9 councilman in this area in 2009, reelected to another term. He is a person who has four children. Good morning to you, Joel Boy.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Now, as the father of four, what are your reflections and insights regarding the tragedy in Connecticut last week?
Well, it was extremely tragic. I've got four children under the age of six, so it really hits close to home to think. In fact, when I found out about this on Friday, I was actually picking up my three-year-old daughter from preschool, and it's just it's tragic in so many ways to see that this young man went to such extremes and killed so many innocent children. It's very disheartening to see that happen.
What do you think about changes in gun laws?
You know, certainly that's our constitutional right to bear arms, and I think we need to be very careful in how we look at that. You know, gun restrictions, background checks, things of that nature have been happening for years. And quite honestly, looking at this situation, if there were increased gun control, does not mean that the outcome is any different than what it is today. You have bad people that are doing bad things. We have criminals out there that are breaking laws, committing crimes. Who's to say that additional legislation or additional restrictions on gun control? We're dealing with criminals. They're breaking the law, and they're going to continue to break the law.
Well, these people last week were not criminals. The man who did the killing, Adam Lanza, he had no record, but he did have three semi-automatic weapons he was using. Should he have been able to use those?
Well, I think based under our constitutional right, he was within his right to own and have those arms in his hands. The end result, he did not have the right to do that by any means. It's just a tragic situation all around.
What do you think, Kwame, as far as some kind of restriction on purchase of semi-automatic weapons?
Well, I agree with policy that's out there that wants to protect our Second Amendment of the Constitution. But at the same time, I think that we've got to find a means of limiting the use of these semi-automatic weapons. As President Obama said, that weapons that have been used for war are now being brought home and for recreation in our streets and our homes. We want to take that opportunity for folks who are, you know, who are in possession of these type of weapons that can create such mass destruction. So I believe that limiting the access to those type of high-powered weapons is one thing. I think that also dealing with the mental health aspect is another. Children who are adults or individuals have been that can be recognized as being very troubled that will have all the signs of hurting themselves or hurting others. We need to link the two. That's going to take a lot of work, a lot of communication. It's going to take some very good, smart policy people to deal with the privacy aspect. But I think they're the individuals we've seen in the last number of years who created such mass tragedies also suffer with particular issues around mental health. So I think those are going to be two areas that we've got to really focus on.
Mariano writes, the man who committed the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School was a psychopath. Now is the perfect time to discuss mental illness. Adam Lanza should have been on a social worker's caseload. He probably should have been on behavior modification medication, or at the very least under the care of a psychiatrist, writes Mariano. These are the questions that should be part of the national discussion after this horrific incident. Our mental health system needs to identify and provide services to individuals who are prone to violent behavior. Strict gun laws only restrain the law-abiding citizens. No gun control law will ever prevent a determined, deranged individual from acquiring a gun and committing mass murder, writes Mariano. Paul in Opelousas. Paul, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning. Just so I want to attest to your popularity of your show. This morning on NPR, it was announced that Dick's Sporting Goods, and another big box retailer will not be selling certain rifles. And I remember your guest yesterday proposed everybody who gets one return it back. So thank you, Jim, for that.
Well,
that
well, thank you, Paul. I appreciate it. That was Reverend Crump who said that.
And question for the NAACP spokesperson. What is the health of the NAACP now? I know there was some controversy a while back on the national level. What will the NAACP look like in the next 20 years?
Kwame, what about the future of the NAACP?
The NAACP's health looks very strong as far as in terms of our membership. Our membership is still growing. Our membership is still increasing. However, this is a different kind of NAACP than probably many people would believe, have seen in the 60s and the 70s, addressing particular issues around discrimination and access to certain civil rights. So the NAACP today is not confronted with the same types of discrimination, desegregation types of issues that made the NAACP a prominent organization. Our organization now still deals with the same amount of discrimination, but it's a different type of discrimination, less overt, more institutionalized, more policy-driven, but the issues are still the same. We're always dealing with issues around education, but no longer are we just simply talking about African-American children and Caucasian children going to school together. We're also talking about and dealing with issues around underachievement by African-American children, the number of dropouts that are happening nationwide, the learning levels of children, in particularly inner city and urban areas.
All right. Well, Kwame, we thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to a discussion with you again soon. You're obviously an eloquent man, and we need to talk more. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you. Joel Boy is still with us, the councilman from District 9. What about the murder rate in Baton Rouge, Councilman Boy? We're probably going to have a record year for homicides this year. What can be done in the near term to address this?
Yes, unfortunately, it looks like there will be a record for the year 2012, which is not something that we as a city or a parish are proud of. I think there's a couple of things that have happened over the last year that are small steps in the goal of reducing crime and eliminating crime in the parish. A couple of things such as the BRAVE program that we've all heard so much about, the truancy program that our district attorney, Hiller Moore, has championed. And then also, you probably saw we had a graduation of 30-plus cadets that are now on the streets working for the Baton Rouge Police Department as of a couple of days ago. Those are all small things, but when you put all those things together, working toward the common goal of reducing crime, all of those begin to pay dividends in some form or fashion.
Robert on Millerville. Good morning, Robert. You're on with Councilman Bowie.
Yes, if I could, please. If we could go back to the issue of the shooting.
Yes, sir.
And the mental health issue.
Okay.
I'm a Baton Rouge resident, and I have a daughter who's approaching 30 who has the same type of illness, the same type of autism as the shooter. And over the last couple of years, my wife and I, have dealt with our daughter. One of us had to leave our jobs just to give a 24-hour care. After 7 years of waiting, we finally got a Louisiana Now waiver, which allows her to stay in the community, but watch 24 hours a day. And I wonder sometimes if Louisiana has looked to see how it handles its mental health citizens. I noticed that they're closing down the hospital in Mandeville, rather. And they've shut down others. Rumor has it that Greenwell Springs was shut down, and Governor General's brother's about to buy it. But I think we kind of look beyond the needs of our citizens and don't really have a concern for people with mental health. Recently, I've had a friend who had a family member to go in the hospital 5 times in about 2 weeks. She stays 3 days, and then they release her, not totally able to go back and perform in society.
All right. Thank you, Robert. Joel Bowie, do you have any thoughts about mental health and how we're addressing this issue and funding the treatment for people who have challenges along these lines?
If, from a state and federal standpoint, I'm not going to be able to say much from that perspective, but I will say, at least on a local, from a local standpoint, that our coroner's office, Dr. Bo Clark, his office obviously serves as the coroner, but he also has responsibility for mental health issues as well. And that's something that I think I've found over the years a lot of people really aren't familiar with when they get put into a situation where they have, whether it's friends or family that are in need of mental health evaluation, or family members that need mental health evaluation, that service does exist here on a local level through the coroner's office. So that's something that might be a resource to some people here locally in the parish.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to join us. Joel Bowie with us a bit longer, the Metro Councilman from District 9. Mike in Kensington writes, I frequently hear that you cannot control guns and still let sane gun owners have free access to their guns. This is not true. I lived in an Asian country for 5 years where all guns were stored in local police stations with the exception of shotguns in rural areas. When someone wanted to go target shooting or hunting, they checked out their gun or guns and told the police when they would return them and where they would be. If a handgun or other concealed gun was used in the commission of a crime, the person was charged under the National Security Act, and the penalty was hanging, which they usually carried out in less than a year. Consequently, few people ever killed with a gun, maybe knives or machetes, but not with guns. I know that this will never happen in the U.S., but it speaks to the question that guns can be controlled and let sensible people have access to them. Veronica on Old Hammond. Veronica, good morning. You're on with Councilman Bowie.
My question goes back to local crime here in Baton Rouge. I've had enough of being tired and scared, afraid, and just sad. My question is, what can regular citizens do to be more active and participate or even help out? Thanks.
All right. Councilman, what can regular citizens do?
I mean, I think the biggest thing, and this doesn't cost any money and it doesn't take a whole lot of time to do it, but is simply to participate in the process. And don't be afraid to pick up the telephone and call the police if you see something suspicious. The Sheriff's Department and Police Department have always told us as council people to encourage our constituents and the residents to don't feel like you're bothering us by calling. Hopefully what you're calling about and what you're reporting is a non-event and it doesn't turn into an event. But the more information that we're able to give and lend to the police department and the sheriff's department, the more beneficial that they can be in helping fight crime in any particular area of the parish. So I think the biggest thing is simply to get involved, pick up the phone. Don't feel like you're bothering our police departments. Pick up the phone and call. In the event that there's anything suspicious, you see something that's out of whack. And then the other thing is just to have a relationship with your neighbors, with your neighborhood association. If you're looking out for each other, I think that's one of the first steps in the right direction to make sure that we're all protected.
HB in Denham Springs, please be brief. HB, good morning to you.
Good morning, sir. Quick comment on this. Since I first heard of the massacre in Connecticut, I immediately went out and lowered my flag to half-mast in prayer in honor of those who lost their lives in Connecticut and Newport. I find it highly unusual and disappointing to me that I see no flags even at schools at half-mast when the same thing could very easily happen here.
All right, we've got to go to a break, but thank you for the observation, HB. Back in a moment. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A line is open for the first time in a while. Joel Bowie, councilman from District 9, is with us for a little while longer. And we're talking about carnage in Connecticut and about the murder rate in Baton Rouge. And HB, as we went to the break, was talking about flags being lowered to half-mast, and I was at LSU over the weekend, and I did notice the flag at the parade grounds was lowered to half-mast, as it should be in recognition for the tragedy in Connecticut. Ryan and Gonzalez. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air with Councilman Bowie. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Just, you know, I work in the mental health field, and, you know, the state and Governor General have really just slashed mental health budget. And, you know, Asperger's, which won't even really exist after they come out with the new DSM-5, it'll just be part of autism spectrum disorder. You know, it's not a dangerous thing. They're putting it on the mental health. And I guess the last thing I would like to say is, you know, the Second Amendment allows us the right to bear arms. But, you know, when our founding fathers were running around with muskets, I don't think this is what they had in mind, that everyone would have the right to a semi-automatic weapon. It's a little bit different aiming and firing a musket than it is aiming and firing a semi-automatic weapon.
Thank you, Ryan. Councilman?
No, I agree. I personally own handguns and I own hunting rifles and shotguns of that nature. But whether it's sport shooting or hunting, I have absolutely no need for a high-powered semi-automatic Bushmaster such as what we're talking about here. And I agree. I think the original intent of our founding forefathers, you're 100% correct, that a musket was the only weapon of choice at the time, or a small handgun, and what it's evolved into over the years is something far outreaching of what probably anybody ever imagined.
Walmart, which is the world's largest retailer, has removed an information page on Bushmaster from its website. However, Walmart indicates it has made no changes to its sales policies on guns and ammunition. Recently, the company has been increasing emphasis on gun sales after a five-year period during which it backed away from them. 2975633, Jack on Bluebonnet. Good morning, Jack. You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you, Councilman Buddy, for being a part of this conversation. Just wanted to comment on the use of the coroners for commitment. It is an option that we use and that is available. Unfortunately, those holds are typically, I believe, for 72 hours, where a physician can commit someone for 48 hours as well. This can definitely be useful in starting the process of getting these individuals' attention and to get them to where they can potentially get help. Unfortunately, there's just not many facilities, it seems, around that are able to receive these individuals. They get stuck in emergency room beds, tying up, you know, valuable resources for our general population. And I think there needs to be an overhaul of the medical mental health care system. Without the ability to get these individuals treatment, you're going to just continue to see this cycle revolve over and over. Myself personally, I had a family member that I had to have committed, and luckily I had financial resources that I was able to put them in private treatment. And private treatment runs upwards of approximately $9,000 a week. The healthcare model that we had and the system that we have, at least here in Metropolitan Baton Rouge, is lacking and inadequate. And I really think we need to look at expounding that system and potentially building on that, whether it comes through local funding, state funding, or federal funding. It's something that definitely needs to be looked at and definitely needs to be addressed.
Okay. Thank you, Jack. I appreciate it. Brent on Florida. Hi, Brent. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jim. The gentleman was talking about when the founding fathers had this law enacted that a musket was the only gun they had. At the time, that was the most powerful gun available. It's the law abiders, not the laws, that need to be worked on. Education and doing something about these kids that have nothing to do, to run the streets, and the parents can't do anything with them because the state won't let them do anything to them, and there's no place to put them. We got to work on the law abiders, not the laws.
Well, that was not the case of Adam Lanza. He had apparently a devoted mother. Unfortunately, she taught him how to shoot a gun, and he used three high-powered weapons to kill 26 people and then killed himself.
in the paper it said that she was having trouble with him. He was incorrigible, I think was the word they used. And so I'm thinking maybe she thought if she found something they could relate together, be it the guns or something, she could maybe try to get him to be, you know, something they could do together.
Well, why would you give an unstable person a gun?
Do you think if she knew he was unstable? I was trying to raise a stepdaughter who I was walking down the street and she was refusing to come home. The cops said I couldn't touch her. I couldn't bring her home after 11 o'clock when it was no longer her curfew. They still wouldn't pick her up. They told me if she went to the 7-Eleven and robbed the store, I was held accountable.
All right. Thank you, sir.
What do you do with them? They're adults.
You have any insights, Councilman Boy?
Well, I think hindsight's 20/20, especially concerning what happened in Connecticut. There's probably dozens of people who are telling themselves today that, you know, we knew something was different with this individual. We knew something was wrong. Why didn't we do something to try and stop it early on? And I think that brings out the measure of being proactive versus reactive. And I think from a mental health standpoint, I think that's the biggest target here is to target these people. Not that everybody out there is going to do something so heinous as this individual did, but to have a resource, a facility, a place that parents, friends, coworkers can use that resource to help urge these individuals to get some help, you know, in an effort to be proactive. Right now we're talking in a reactive mode, but being proactive to stop something like this in the future, I think mental health is going to be the major key to stop this.
Well, and to show how unstable this young man was, and it's a story that is tragic and hard to discuss, but it's probably worth mentioning that the latest indications are that Mr. Lanza shot his mother, Nancy, with a .22 caliber rifle at close range in the face while she was asleep. Nate Silver, the 538.com man who has been on the mark in the last two presidential elections and studies numbers of all kinds, he says in 1973, about 55% of Republicans reported having a gun in their house against 45% of Democrats. And then he adds that gun ownership has declined over the last 40 years, but almost all of the decline has come from Democrats. By 2010, according to the General Social Survey, the gun ownership rate among the gun among adults that identified as a Democrat had fallen to 22% and remained at 50% among Republican adults. So there, like many other things in our society, Councilman Bowie, there appears to be a partisan divide on this issue.
That's interesting. I had not seen or heard those numbers before, but those are some very interesting statistics.
And it's curious that many members of Congress and the governor of Louisiana have yet to weigh in on this. I would hope they will at some juncture, and sooner the better. Jarrett on the Basin Bridge. Hi, Jarrett. You're on with Councilman Bowie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy the show. I was calling in to discuss the talk about banning the semi-automatic weapons. But first, I want to say that was very interesting statistics about the political leanings of gun owners, and I wonder if that has anything to do with the rural population versus urban population.
Well, it might, but Councilman, what do you think? Rural people quite often use guns for hunting, more so than people in the cities do. There isn't as much to hunt in the city, unless you're hunting people, and unfortunately we have some folks who do that, but more people in rural areas tend to be Republican. So Jared may be onto something. What do you think, Councilman?
I think he may be onto something. I think it's a strong possibility that there may be a correlation, that those in the rural areas are involved in hunting. They may possibly have the land and the access to be able to sport shoot and hunt. So I think it's a strong possibility.
Well, I'm looking through some of Nate Silver's information right now, and he goes into this to some extent. He says Gun ownership rates are highest in rural areas, where guns are more likely to be used for hunting as well as personal protection. A slight majority of Democratic voters in rural areas say they had a gun in their home, according to the survey, although the rate was higher, 65% among Republicans. In urban areas, 40% of Republican voters said they had a gun in their home, 20% of Democrats had a gun in their homes. Mike on Sherwood. Mike, you're on WRKF.
As long as the general culture has this extreme fascination and preoccupation with guns, I don't think any of these methods are going to be successful. Something's got to change in the culture. If you just look at statistics of murder rates by guns by country and compare that or correlate that with the number of guns owned by the general public, it's a no-brainer. I understand self-defense, I understand hunting, but the amount of guns on the street, legal and illegal, is just toxic. I'll wait for a response on the radio after I hang up.
Well, Councilman, there have been efforts to get guns off the streets in Baton Rouge. How is this working?
Well, there's certainly been some buyback programs that have been hosted over the last few years that have been somewhat successful in getting guns off the streets. But I think to allude to the caller's comment about a fascination with guns, I think it's evidenced by, I did some research last night, three of the top four video games that are being sold on the market today nationwide are all violence and gun-related, where you win by shooting people. You have Halo, Call of Duty, Assassin's Creed. These are the top video games that people in the United States are purchasing, and unfortunately that parents are purchasing for their own underage children. I think Call of Duty is, there's going to be a lot of young kids that receive this gift for Christmas this year, which I think is completely sending the wrong message to our young people.
Here's a question from Mariana. She writes, why do the mental health and gun control conversations have to be mutually exclusive? It seems like gun advocates are using mental health to deflect some responsibility. We should be talking about both. I think she has a point, Councilman.
I think she does. I just think in this particular situation, you have an individual that was obviously not mentally right in all aspects, and no person in their right frame of mind commits such a heinous crime as what was committed here. So I think they've got to be tied together. I don't think mental health should be used to deflect gun regulation either, but I think in this particular case, they're one and the same. You've got to talk about both of them in the same conversation.
Here's another question. As for crime in Baton Rouge, how much of the gun crime is random acts of violence that everyone seems to be so afraid of, and how much of it involves people who know each other or drugs?
From my perspective, very few of these crimes, the violent crimes, are strictly random. Don't get me wrong, it happens, and we all have to be vigilant and be aware of our surroundings to where we don't put ourselves in that type of position. I think the majority of what we're seeing in the newspaper and on the news is drug-related. It's people that know each other. It's turf wars. It's issues that have perpetuated, and it's payback in some sense, to where it's different groups of people that are fighting with other groups of people, and unfortunately they turn to violent crime to settle the score versus whether it be a fist fight or talking it out. They're turning to guns and knives and things of that nature.
Leonard Joseph writes, since we live in a democracy, we as voters are responsible for what happens in our communities and our country, good or bad. Carter and Karen Crow. Carter, you're on WRKF.
Hello. There was recently in the New York Times an opinion piece written by a psychologist who studied these mass shooters and suicide bombers, and he said that in that article that the psychological profile for both those kind of people, the mass shooters in the U.S. and the suicide bombers in the Middle East and other parts of the world is basically the same. These are people that want to go ahead and make a big statement by going out and killing lots of people, especially innocent people, and making themselves famous for doing that. I thought that was interesting, but the means that they use are different, and they're based on our culture. The other thing recently I like to point out is it was recently an attempt at mass murder in China at an elementary school, but there the attacker only had a knife available to him, and so there were over 20 children wounded, but none of them were killed. And I think that difference between having a gun and having a knife available makes a huge difference in these kind of mass murders.
Thank you, Carter. Councilman Boy?
Well, yeah, certainly a gun is much more efficient from that standpoint. You know, it's, once again, it's just such an unfortunate incident here that we've seen happen over and over again, whether it's in an elementary school or a college or a high school or middle school. It's just unfortunate that these people have a tendency that, you know, they're convinced that they're going to go out with a bang, for lack of a better term, and now they're going to live in infamy. They're not going to be famous for what they've done good. They're going to be infamous for what they've done bad.
Dan downtown, you'll be our final caller. Dan.
Hi, yes. Good morning. I think it's really interesting. I appreciated what the previous caller said, that we talk about what's happening with the councilman. He said regarding retaliatory attacks and drug-related affairs versus the kind of randomness that we saw in Newtown. And I think we have to look at them different. It's hard to imagine how you say something like mental illness and just sort of imagine that we can profile all the mentally ill individuals in this country to ward off such a kind of attack. It would seem that, like the case in China proved, that if you can take those guns out of such crazy individuals' hands, you can do a lot of good while dealing with larger cultural issues. But if we pretend like what happens in North Baton Rouge...
We've got a role. But thank you very much, Dan. Good point. And thank you, Councilman Bowie, for joining us today. Let's talk again soon.
Okay, thank you. Y'all have a great day.
And thanks, everybody, for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.